Good morning. A lot of excitement, buzz in the room. We welcome you, and today we've the House and the Senate Revenue Committee, interim Revenue Committees, have joined together for the momentous occasion of the for the presentation of the forecast. Senator Deckert, any words of wisdom and introduction?
Not really, no. You know, the Senate committee met. None of us have any gubernatorial announcements. We've decided that in our early morning meeting, and so we're here and anxious to get the forecast.
Excellent. Thank you very much. And we have the Office of Economic Analysis, State Economist Tom Potowski. Tom, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the House Revenue Committee, and guests of the Senate Revenue Committee. For the record, my name is Tom Potowski, State Economist with the Office of Economic Analysis in DAS. Today, we are releasing formally our 2005 December economic and revenue forecast. The full document will be simultaneously posted on our website as we speak. The full printed document will be available in approximately 1 week. Going to go rather quickly through the economic outlook that also adds to how our revenue outlook is constructed. And I'll go quickly through that so we can get to the revenue and you can get on to probably your more important meeting today with the tax expenditure report. Okay. As you recall, we go through a process that's approximately 10 to 8 weeks long, each quarterly forecast. We meet with the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors. We look over what's happening with the national economy, because a lot of those are drivers for the Oregon model. Then we come back to the Governor's Council. We also meet with a DAS advisory committee on an all-day session in Salem. Once that is formulated and agreed upon, that works into the revenue models. We also have a meeting then each quarter with the Council of Revenue Forecast Advisors that also assist us, and then finally we come with the package that you see today. This is quickly just a look at Global Insight, which is a national forecasting service that we use, and how they're looking at how the national economy is shaping up, which also influences the Oregon economy. They don't believe there is any recession that is out there in the near future, say the next 2 years. OCEA is the Oregon Council and Economic Oregon Council of Economic Advisors, the Governor's Council, and their viewpoint is not quite as optimistic as the Global Insight. They see a slight 5% chance of a recession, but that's a very, very low probability. But likewise, from their September view, they are slightly more optimistic for the outlook relative to they were just a couple of months ago. Their concerns are mostly around energy prices, inflation, the federal deficit, interest rates, what's happening in the housing market, international conditions. A couple of recent trends there, savings rate touches below zero. It's expected to go back up. If you can keep your savings rate at negative, that's a good trick to do, but it eventually catches up to you, and you have to either cut down on consumption or eventually raise those savings up. So that's an indication that possibly there could be a little bit of slowing in spending in the near future. Unemployment by region, this is one of the better pictures we've seen in quite a while. These are not seasonally adjusted, so some of those eastern counties, this is the lowest unemployment rates you'll see any time during the year, basically. But still, especially for the Portland metro area, this has really come down to the sort of high 8% that we saw during the recession. Our exports have bounced back up. Our trading partners have improved a little bit. We've seen some improvement pretty much across the board, and so that's a good sign. Next. We do a Oregon Index leading economic indicators to help us sort of view when turning points happen. Although the indicator there, as you can see at the end, the darker line is bouncing around the zero line, we see that more of an indication that the economy is more in the sort of mature phases of the business cycle, and we're coming down to a more slower, longer-term growth pattern rather than the very strong growth we've recently seen. The red bars is taking a look at employment from the peak of employment before the recession, which was in November of 2000, to October of this year. And if a red bar has been positive, that says that these sectors have now added jobs beyond their previous peak. You can see there's one sector, two actually, yeah, but one in particular that has not increase beyond its previous peak, and that's manufacturing. The blue bar is from mid-2003 to now, and you can see that manufacturing did add some jobs, as all sectors have added jobs, but still they're down on net somewhere in the order of 18,000 jobs. And it's pretty much across the board in this area. We've seen particular strength in transportation equipment recently, even wood products, metals and machinery. But really, it's high tech. We've seen improvements, but they are the ones that are kind of lagging, really, I think, in terms of this employment growth picture. Next. Our outlook, you can see the peak there in 2005 at 3.2%, still not as strong as the 5 years above 3% we saw in the mid-1990s. But notice that we do follow the U.S. Cycle fairly closely, bouncing around here and there. And we believe that we've gotten the big, strong jump up now. It's easy to add workers in recovery. You've got excess capacity. You can bring them on fast. Now that you start to reach that point, you start to have a little bit of a slowdown, but it's still positive growth we see out for the next couple of years. Next. Manufacturing, you can see that these downs are much deeper than what the up positives have been, and that's where you get that net still down in terms of jobs for the sector. Once again, we don't believe that this is going to grow by any great extent to these outer years. This is not unusual for Oregon. This is basically every state's facing this sort of manufacturing picture. Next. Private non-manufacturing is what's been growing. You can see the spike up there in 2005, and we expect that to still be positive and slowing down. You've really had health care has done quite well. Retail, wholesale trade has picked up. Information sector, which includes publishers of software, pretty much across the board, the service sector has done fairly well. Next. Comparison of our last three forecasts. You can see 2002 there. You know, it's difficult enough to forecast the future without having the past change on you. I think he has a pacer, and it just set off.
That was my pacer.
That was your. The Bureau of Economic Analysis really boosted up what they thought income growth was in Oregon. They revised back to 2002. And you can see those pretty much levels stay the same. So we've pretty much had a level bounce up in that income. Looking out in the future, not much of a change out in those outer years. Better growth, but still lagging behind, really, although you can't see the true mid-1990s there. Really not quite as strong as we saw back there. And part of that, too, is our picture because manufacturing is also not as strong back there. We have a lot of the higher wage jobs in that sector. Comparison of our employment forecast, you can see that we've bounced that up in 2005. We've increased 2006 just a little bit, and pretty much the same forecast out for the future. Housing prices have been in the news lately, and you can see that these housing prices have really shot up. Medford, if we had any possible, I think, housing bubble in Oregon, it might be the Medford area. And maybe a little bit of Bend. You know, four quarters straight of above 20% growth is quite the jump. A lot of this also is dependent on what happens in California. If California, where I would expect if there is a housing bubble in the U.S., that's really where it's at, if that should burst and that type of appreciation, people being able to cash out, is not available, that would slow down the area, especially in Medford and the Bend area. Yes. Just if those of you curious about Katrina and Rita impacts that might have had on the Oregon economy, the chart on the right here, what I want to just point out here is that Oregon is one of many, many places providing supplies of wood products to the Gulf region. And because of that, it's very, very competitive. Mm-hmm. And you can tell just by the prices for framing lumber and structural panel, they've actually come down. And they're really not as high as they were back in 2004. So we think a little bit of a boost, but not much.
We do have a question, Tom. Representative Berger is recognized.
Tom from work on this committee, I'm aware that Oregon has been a leader in manufacturing, is strong in manufacturing of RVs and that kind of thing. There's a lot of them in use down there in the impacted areas. Does that have any impact on our economy, short-term or long-term?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, it has had a mild impact. Monaco Coach is, I think, producing most of those out of their Indiana plant, although there has been some spillover to other types of fifth wheeler and that kind of activity in the sort of Eugene-Coburg area, but definitely temporary.
Okay.
Not a long-term aspect. Definitely just a temporary boost up. Rebuilding phase, as I said, we think it's just a mild sort of boost to demand for Oregon wood products. Trailers, freeze-dried food, water purification, all these smaller firms in Oregon have been supplying, but once again, it's a temporary supply. We've also seen some costs going up. Resin seems to be a major manufacturing item out of the Gulf of Mexico, and that's using PVC pipe. So in terms of residential and building constructions, their costs have gone up accordingly because of this. Of course, the energy costs have been important. The natural gas is probably affecting our area. A lot of the Canadian gas now gets piped down, not just to us, but through into Chicago, and that area has been constrained by the gas, natural gas coming up from the Gulf of Mexico, and that's going to probably raise our prices up, too. So overall, very mild and temporary increase in demand because of the Katrina Rita situation. This is from your handout, a big longer slide, and I'm going to kind of quickly go through it because I think these are two of the biggest risks we're seeing out there right now is the oil and the housing situation to the economic outlook and thus the revenue outlook. And so, as I said here, you know, one bubble we hope does burst, the other we hope does not. Oil, which is one of the bubbles we hope does burst, impacting the Oregon economy in the U.S., definitely disruptions that could occur because of geopolitical. We've seen the natural disasters. We could see prices spiking quite high. It could lead to inflation and also a slower economy. But there are bright spots that this may not be the outcome. Most of the oil price increases have been demand-driven this time around as opposed back in the early 1980s when it was supply-driven. There was a huge shortage of supply that was not available, as opposed to today, which is more demand-driven. That is actually, no one likes a higher price of oil and higher price of energy, but from the demand-driven, those price aspects then can cause conservation in these items and then slightly slowing down of their use, as opposed to if you don't have the supply of the energy and you have the high price, then you to conserve on them, you're even further behind the eight ball than you are in a demand-driven situation. Even with the energy price rise, we've seen very little pressure on overall prices so far. In the third quarter, we saw a bump up because of the huge bump up of the speculation on oil prices because of the Katrina situation, but that wasn't long-lived, and we're already seeing, you know, definitely below $2.50 is pretty widespread, even in our state, which has been relatively high. We're still in a period of rather low inflationary expectations, so we haven't seen that bouncing back up like we did in the 80s. And then the world is also less dependent today on oil than it was 30 years ago. And even when we had those big spikes back in late August, early September, they still were below, in real terms, the prices we saw in the early 1980s. In terms of the housing, what dangers do we have here? Yes. Since 2001, they've accounted for 30% of GDP growth. So the growth in the housing market has really been a driver of what's happened in the national economy. Since 2002, housing-related activities responsible for over 1 million jobs. Year over year, September median price of homes have gone up 14.3%. First mortgage originations are up 10% in the first half of 2005 compared to the first half of 2004. The share of these increases have been things like interest-only ARMs, option ARMs, and Alt-A mortgages. From my understanding of Alt-A, if you come in and you say that to the loan officer, you know, I can't really substantiate my credit history. They say, okay, we'll give you an Alt-A and you can still have your mortgage. And they pay just a little bit higher. So what we're seeing this share, this is some indication of getting the more speculative action that's going on in the housing market.
Tom, I'd understood that, and I'm trying to remember whether it was for the whole year last year or whether it represented the entire body of new loans in California. I understood that 70% of the new loans, I think was the statistic, of all new loans in California, home loans in California, were interest only. Are we seeing that same kind of a heavy interest-only trend in Oregon?
Representative Butler, we have some anecdotal information that is maybe to the 30-40% range in Oregon, but definitely has climbed in recent times.
Which really is an indication that those loans are being taken out on a speculative basis on the 14.3% increase in home prices or some high percentage of increase in values, the speculation that will continue.
Mr. Chair, I think that's right.
Okay.
U.S. homes up 13.4%. In Oregon, we see them up 15.9% in the second quarter of 2005, largest increase since 1979. Okay. And then the danger is that all this activity could go away. There are still, I think, some hopes on this. I don't necessarily see it as a price bubble, especially in Oregon, but maybe we'll call it frothing. You know, you've got the boiling water, you've got little bubbles, and then as the heat gets turned down, it's just going to settle down. There's going to be corrections, but it's not going to be a huge collapse.
Representative Berger's recognized?
I'm not sure what you mean by that. What you mean is that it's not a bubble that's going to collapse all the way down. If it collapses, it'll just collapse the froth. Is that what you're trying to imply here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, yes. I think, just as Mr. Chair pointed out about the speculative action, this is more what I would consider a more recent phenomenon in the price appreciation of housing, rather than something that's been very hot and heavy since, you know, early, say, 2000. So that the correction that happens, these will be the people and the institutions that have been loaning to them, and any construction that is rapidly trying to get new homes out there. The new people, the new players are the ones that will be affected by a correction. And so I kind of view it as, you know, if I bought a house in 2001 and now I've got a, you know, 40% appreciation and the price should happen to go down, say, 10%, even 15%, I'm okay. I mean, I may not like that, but I'm not going to be devastated. But it's just the most recent people.
Follow up, Representative.
Yeah, I think this is, I'm pursuing this, I think, because the likelihood, I think, is high. Could be dramatic in Oregon. And so I'm going to ask, and your issues here are with Oregon. What does it look like in California in terms of that frothing construct?
Mr. Chair,
because what happens in California has an impact.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, yes, you take a look at the House Affordability Index for California, and even with their relatively high, you know, personal incomes, they really are very low on that affordability index compared to other states. And they've had an extreme, you know, rapid appreciation in their home prices. And with the type of speculative action going on, just a little correction, you know, can start the cards falling. I would worry. That's why I would worry about certain parts of Oregon, the Medford area, Bend, in that if the California situation has a major correction, then there would be spillover effects to those regions.
And those real estate corrections in California seem to have, Oregon seems to follow those same corrections, maybe sometimes not with the same severity, but they have corrections in California every few years, and that much of what our real estate economy in Oregon is predicated upon is the fact that Californians are going to continue to come in and buy homes in Medford and Bend and along the Oregon coast. So my concern is, you know, I think Representative Berger's touched on that. What happens in California is very critical to what our forecast looks like.
Representative Butler, I would agree. Also, though, when we talk to people in the Bend area especially, they've also noticed a slight change from previous, you know, California running into the area, in that inquiries seem to be even worldwide now, more so than in the past. So I think there's a slight, in a sense, buffer in that regard. But still, the majority, yes, is still a California influence.
Well, when you consider California has one of the major worldwide economies itself, standalone, it's not uncommon then to believe that the same folks that are investing in Bend and yep. on the Oregon coast and coming up to southern Oregon.
Vail.
Right, in Vail, Ontario. and we are seeing some from Arizona, too, in that
yes.
process, too.
Chair?
Representative...
Thank you. Follow-up to Representative Berger's okay. question. Should hypothetically the bubble happen, what do you forecast the impact on housing starts in Oregon and, therefore, construction and timber?
Mr. Chair, Representative Boquist. We're looking at in 2006 somewhere of a drop of maybe about 7.5% for housing starts in Oregon. That's sizable, but it could be worse. I mean, there's a risk to that forecast. Also, we see construction slowing down from its heights. It's been growing over 9% in terms of employment. We think that'll come back down to more like the 2% range and then maybe drop below that as we get in 2007. So it'll still stay positive, but this huge strength will definitely go away.
Representative Bird, Representative Boquist, was that responsive?
Yes, Bird? And I just wanted to follow up. Those numbers that you just gave us are reflected in this forecast?
Yes, it is.
Thank you.
Just quickly, speculative activity, I said most recent phenomenon. I think I've covered these points. Yes, go ahead. I think that's. And then the last one is the other part is the federal tax reform recommendation that's come out to try to change the national tax situation. And I think any aspect of trying to put a cap on mortgage deductions is dead in the water, politically. So that won't be one of the factors that could possibly slow down the housing market.
We did touch base on that briefly yesterday. Yes, Senator Whitsitt is recognized.
Thank you, Chair Butler. To go back just a minute to the oil bubble.
Yes.
Instead, the world is less dependent on oil today than it was 30 years ago. Looking at the literature from the petroleum industry, they're telling us that the demand in China and India, Pakistan, other emerging economies for industrial and transportation fuels is huge. And so I wonder how, could you expand on that statement that the world is less dependent when it appears that the petroleum companies are telling us that the demand is greater?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, yes, in terms of actual number of barrels of oil that we are demanding today is higher than it was back in 1980. What's changed is our efficient use of oil. Oil, I believe back in 1980s, were something like 16% of GDP activity was dependent on us using that much oil. In terms of its composition. And now it's somewhere like 8%, in that our factories are more efficient. Even though we got a lot of SUVs out there, the SUVs that are running are much more efficient than the same size vehicles were back in the early 1980s. So in terms of our efficiency of using the oil, we're less dependent. But given our economies are bigger, China is bigger and a player that wasn't there before, the actual total demand for oil is up.
Yes, I'm sorry. Representative Escobar.
I just arrived home last month from a trip to Beijing and Shanghai. And according to the information I received in China, Beijing is a population of about 13 million people, but they're putting 2,000 cars per day on the road, new. So take that in conjunction with the rest of China, and you can see a substantial amount of demand in the horizon with China itself. A third of the world's cranes are in China, building cranes. I mean, it's unbelievable what they're doing over there. So they're going to start sapping demand out of the rest of the economy of the world.
Representative Esquivel, they are pretty much in the number two position right now for the use of oil, demand for oil. Interestingly enough, economics takes time to work, but it is starting to work. The high price is starting to eke out bigger supplies of oil available. There have been more explorations actually around China, and they're finding deposits. Alberta seems very poised and ready to go with their sand oil, which has a deposit that's close to what Saudi Arabia has. Shell is exploring in Colorado the shale oil that they left because the price went down. They're back again with new technology that's cheaper now to extract it. So, I think more positive, at least coming down the road here. We've got some bullets to dodge, but as I think we're ending this decade, we may see quite a bit of supply of oil out there. Good and bad, depending on your view. You know, this might have been our opportunity to really get away from oil and find alternative fuel sources. But if the supplies do come back, then that going down that road will once again be put off for a while.
Thank you.
These are just risks that we've talked about before, so I'm just going to go to the next slide and give our summary. We finally are seeing job growth starting in 2004. Our outlook, 3.2%, and then a slower growth but still positive outlook. Manufacturing, essentially flat through the next couple of years. Non-manufacturing, service sectors where our growth will occur. And then personal income, not as high as the mid-1990s, but definitely better than we saw during the recession, and then settling down in 2007. And that, our outlook, national economy, there's no recession on the near term. We think that we've now are in the more mature stages of our business cycle so that we have positive growth, but slower than what we've seen in 2005. And those factors then lead into our revenue forecast.
Chairman Butler.
Yes, I'm sorry. Representative Comp is recognized.
Tom, back on page 5 or page 4, when you're looking at the long-term employment, I'm a little confused. On that bottom, it's the total non-farm employment. It shows a sizable drop for next year, and yet you said that that's not going to impact us very much. That's almost a 4%.
Mr. Chair, Representative Comp, yes, what we're saying is that we're now surpassed our previous peak in November 2000. We've got an all-new time high for this non-farm employment, and the growth will still be adding to that. We're just going to be adding jobs at a slower rate.
Okay, thank you. That helps me.
Thank you.
Chair, members of the committees, for the record, Michael Kennedy with the Office of Economic Analysis, and I'm going to go through these points here in discussing the revenue forecast. I wanted to start out by taking a general approach to what the revisions here actually represent. And so, as we've said before, the forecast depends upon our economic outlook. And when actual revenues depart from that outlook, it can be the result of two different types of errors as I'm classifying them. One is an error in direction. You expect the economy to grow, it instead contracts and goes into recession. And that's a dramatic type of errors we just experienced. You're going to get large errors and they're going to have large budgetary implications. Another type of error here is just the timing. You've got the general pattern of the economic cycle correct. Recession, recovery, expansion, you just have the timing wrong. You're just off about when each of these phases kicks in, ends, etc. And in terms of this particular forecast, it's really this latter. It's just in terms of trying to get accurately when's the recovery and when is long-term slower expansionary rates kick in. And that's what's going on here. To be more specific here then, when I talk about rebound, as Tom was talking about, when we come out of recession, you have a lot of excess capacity, you have pent-up demand, firms are very lean, and so when you come out, you tend to have these very large rebounds and larger growth rates than you can expect over the longer term. What we were looking for in terms of our recent forecasts of the past year is for that rebound phase to sort of phase out in the middle of 2005 and for things to actually slow down with growth, but still slower growth, beginning in the second half. And that was in part due to a lot of these issues out there, rising mortgage rates, rising energy prices. These things should eventually cause the economy to come down to moderate and long-term growth rates. What's happened in the past, say, 5 months, at looking at our data, is that thing, that growth, that really strong growth, is just continuing into the second half. And so that's really what the issue is here. And what happens is then 2005 looks like a stronger year than we had previously expected. Our long-term outlook hasn't changed at all, so really what happens is just the entire forecast bumps up a little bit. And you'll see that more explicitly as I get into the specific forecast and this point I've already made. So turning to personal income tax, as it is our largest source of revenue, here's the comparison. This is July to November actual collections versus the forecast. And I want to point out, I've split these out into withholding and estimated payments because those are related to current tax year and current activity. And what are we seeing? Withholding and estimated payments both stronger than we had predicted. We'd expected those to slow down a little bit in the second half. Instead, withholding is up 6.5% year over year, which is continuing what it's basically been doing for the last year and a half. And estimated payments continuing to be up in the high teens range, and we're expecting those to eventually come down. Long term, they should really only grow 7 to 8%, you know, over the long term. So that's just making 2005 look stronger than we had expected it to be. Also, final payments and refunds for last year are a little bit stronger in the net, but it's pretty marginal. It's about $8 or $9 million. So when all that is said and done, our expectations for tax liability for 2005 is up about $80 million. And I put it in this way in this graph so you get an idea that that really is a marginal change to the forecast. So you can see here it's slightly higher in the long run, but in absolute terms relative to the magnitude of personal income tax, $5 billion a year, it's still a pretty marginal change. But because it's so large, a marginal change to personal income tax nets you what seems like sizable dollars, as you'll see. Turning to corporate income tax, again, the comparison here, this is really departing from our scenario here. We'd really expected corporate income tax to level out after this big rebound we've seen in the past 2 years. As you can see here, payments for that five-month period are up about $55 million relative to our forecast. And refunds then are down, which is, you've known for the past 2 years, we've said, watch out, we could potentially see some refunds coming online with a lot of these tax law changes. And I'll talk more about that in a second. But what, so I looked at those payments and I said, what's driving those? And so I looked into it in a little more detail. And what this graph is showing is first, total corporate tax payments for the past few years. And you can see, you know, the profile of here's the late 90s and the boom, then the collapse in those payments down to the low of about January of 2003, this surge we've been seeing, which resulted in the kicker from last biennium, and I put next to it manufacturing payments. So these are just the manufacturing firm's payments, and you can see during that period that it really was manufacturing that was driving the profile of that cycle. And in fact, if you'll remember in the past year and a half, we've been talking about a potential echo in these in the manufacturing industry. You had the high-tech boom and the bust, and then we expected that to come back, you know, with investments picking up again. But that with bonus depreciation and with that bunching up of investments, we would expect to see that drop off. And in fact, that's exactly what's happened. You can see there through the profile, we've had that cycle. And it did cause a little drop here in payments, but it's this, we had then expected things to flatten out for the manufacturing industry and for Oregon as a whole, and you can see manufacturing has done that, basically leveled out at some long-term level there. It's that right there. It's this pickup in corporate tax payments beyond manufacturing that has basically defied the forecast. And so in looking at that, I then looked at basically for this 9 months, these payments have increased about 24%. And so I looked in, at what sectors were contributing to that. Half of that is wholesale and retail trade. Another 13% is professional and business services. This is lining up fairly well with the employment figures you've been hearing. Natural resources, information owns 6%, construction. Then you look at manufacturing and financial services, which were the two industries that actually drove what we've been seeing in the last years, and they basically are contributing nothing. So it's a shift in the industrial composition of these payments. And the question then is why? And I'll get to that in a bit. The other thing going on here is our national forecast service, Global Insight, has raised their U.S. corporate profit projections. For 2005, you can see they have a large jump, and then things basically being slow thereafter, this still being all related to recovery, et cetera. So that, in addition, factors into our forecast. So the net changes here, where we had previously been expecting 2005 to be down from 2004 because of this manufacturing echo, these other sectors have basically come in and filled the gap, and so 2005 liability, corporate tax liability, is actually expected to be higher than 2004. So there you get a very large change in the expectations there and in the forecast, and it's basically, again, a level shift. We still expect the future to look roughly like we had been expecting, but if 2005 is better, you just get this bump up in terms of revenue.
Michael, that appears to be driven as by one of your previous slides by the wholesale and retail trade sectors, 49.2% increase, with the negative savings that Tom had previously discussed, particularly the retail side of that, tends to weaken much faster. What portion of the 49.2% is the wholesale trade? Do we know what portion of that is at the wholesale level versus the retail level?
So, Mr. Chair, that 49% is of the growth of the past 9 months.
Right.
That, and it's equal. It's about 24 point whatever percent of each of them. So it's wholesale and retail collectively about contributing roughly half.
And so there's an additional echo that will come out of the wholesale portion of it. The retail will taper off much more rapidly.
Mr. Chair, and we do have, as you see with the forecast here, there's no growth in there,
okay.
And in particular, that's related to those issues, is that this is really seen as sort of this one-time phenomenon with the recovery and with a lot of these issues, business investments, et cetera, but nothing that is going to perpetuate into 06, 07.
I'm just as part of the concern that we'd have as we started to develop budgets based upon this bubble that we're having right now. Senator Deckard, did you have a comment?
Well, just I guess similarly, it just seems to me on that same slide that the areas that are growing are not wealth creators, they are wealth distributors. It's wholesale retail trade, and down where you have your traded sector firms, which would create the wealth that would fuel the financial services, would fuel wholesale and retail trade, are minuscule growth. And so I guess it would lead me to the same conclusion, is that that's not a very sustainable mix where you got 49 and 13 in your service sector and your traded sector is just 2.8 or 5.1. I would say that it's non-sustainable if those figures hold.
Mr. Chair, Senator Decker, the growth obviously is not sustainable. What you have to look at, and just this graph points out alone the volatility of corporate income tax payments, you can see that where it goes from here is up in the air. But basically our scenario is you've seen this growth in these payments by these firms. You're not really sure what's driving it, particularly because they're payments on current tax year, and corporations can end up with large refunds. You're not quite sure what it's relating to specifically in terms of activity. So it's there. The dollars are in the door. You've seen the forecast comparison. And then where we go from here is, okay, you've got those. There's an indication that 2005 is higher, but that doesn't lead us to believe that there's some underlying force like manufacturing drove an entire decade of growth in the 90s.
Thank you. Representative Boquist is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You divided wholesale and retail up Can you define just slightly more what percentage of that is consumer? And the reason being is we've seen a substantial drop and, of course, a negative savings rate. And so how much of this could be driven by consumer spending that was taken out of savings? And, again, it's just a one-time bump.
Mr. Chair, Representative Boquist, that is the question.
Yeah.
When all is said and done, obviously the end result is consumer, is consumption. It's the consumer as an end result, right? What's driving this in 05 remains to be seen. It's, you know, you're looking at tax payments by firms, and they don't always represent real.
Right.
Follow-up representative.
And follow-up, that could it be, could there be a relationship between that and the drop in savings?
Mr. Chair, Representative Boquist, I'm sure some of that is factoring in. We've seen that for 2-3 years now, right, with the refis and the cash out and consumer spending driving a lot of what's going on in the national economy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I might add, Mr. Chair, and Senator Deckard and Representative Boquist, the fall in that savings rate has just been in the last quarter, so it's fairly recent to actually have it go negative. It had been dropping and getting lower. But we've also had at least a little help now at the gas pump, where the squeeze is not as great as it was just in the past quarter. So that's a little bit of help, although there are some worries about, like, natural gas prices and so on, what may happen this winter for households. At the same time, too, the manufacturing sector, we have changed laws, tax laws, such that in that group, one possibility is that we have a lot of multi-state large firms in that manufacturing sector, and going to the single sales factor apportionment, we may see them also in the future paying a less of a tax, even though they're still hiring people, they're still generating, you know, we still have population increase coming in and so on, but they just won't be the contributor that they have been in the past. But we could still see retail and wholesale and stuff like that still doing well because our population base is still growing. It's just that the base that we get from manufacturing will be less.
Thank you.
Continuing, so what does all of this mean? There's actually a lot of information to cover here with the current biennial forecast. Let me start with the beginning balance. Here's where you see the $55 million issue with the Department of Human Services. And we had projected, right, reversions to the general fund, unspent dollars in the previous biennium, and that had included a reversion of about $77 million from the Department of Human Services. Now, as you all have heard, they're not going to revert all of those dollars. So what that means is the beginning balance for this biennium drops $55 million to $301 million. Moving on to personal income tax, then, the implications or ramifications of those issues I just discussed are that personal income taxes are now expected to reach roughly $10.35 billion for the biennium, and that's a $220 million increase from the last forecast. Corporate income tax is up about $87 million to $586. In percentage terms, obviously, that's a much larger forecast change. The personal income tax is only really a 2.2% change from the last forecast. There's a few other issues in the other revenues, particularly interest earnings are doing better with these positive general fund balances. That amounts to a net gain of about $10 million across all those other sources. So the bottom line is that resources, general fund resources for the biennium are now up $263 million to just a little below $12 billion. And when you look at expenditures, you see this $44.9 million drop there. What we had had before was about $49 million in tax anticipation note expense. And with these improving balances, plus some interest rate issues, they got a really good rate and borrowed far less. The expense dropped from 49 to 4.9. So a major savings there resulting from these balance issues. So the net result here is that the ending balance is now projected to be about $461 million. And that's $308 million increase from the prior projection.
Excuse me, Representative Hoff is recognized.
I just, you know, I keep this this forecast and the last forecast. This is more of a comment, I guess. And keep showing there are hundreds of millions of dollars more. And I suppose that's good news, take some pressure off education and the like. But to me, when I see these, I don't really see any cause for celebration. It's to me just as bad. It's easier to take, but just as bad, and shows the same symptomatic problems with our tax code as a couple of years ago, Tom, when you came in and gave us those figures that showed we were down $200 or $300 million every quarter. And to me, this doesn't take the pressure off our need to change our tax code. We found out yesterday the personal income tax is now 90% of our general fund revenues. And as your chart showed, those charts look like the Swiss Alps instead of rolling hills. And, you know, that's our problem. We're taking too much money in the good times and not enough in the bad times. And that's where we have these train wrecks. And I think every person up here on this committee needs to have that at the front of their sort of revenue memory lobe to start working on ways to fix that, because the train wreck will come, whether it's 2 years, 5 years, or 10 years down the road, if we don't change things. That's my editorial for now.
You're advocating, a strong advocate, then, for some kind of a rainy day fund with regard to this excess, huh? Please continue.
So obviously we're entering into kicker ramifications with this forecast. So let me move on to those. So if you look at the close of session estimate for non-corporate income taxes, it was $10.8 billion. So the threshold, the 2% threshold there, is $216 million. That is, if revenues exceed that 2.8 by $216 million, that activates the kicker threshold, and all of the excess then gets rebated to taxpayers as refunds. So right now, with this current forecast, the revenues exceed that threshold. So you would project, if this held out, if this forecast ended up being right, then in fall of 2007, the Department of Revenue would distribute roughly $240 million in kicker refund checks. And I emphasize that if this forecast turned out to be right, note here what the amount above the threshold is. It's $25 million. So, I mean, it's right there, and these forecasts can go up or down, as you've seen, by 200 here or there. So I would call that very tenuous at this point, at best.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Senator Decker.
Thank you. So, Michael, one of the previous slides, it was probably 5 or 6 back, had it showed the effect of bonus depreciation, both the federal and the state, and how that assisted the tax policy that we enact to help assist the recovery in manufacturing. Here's a different slide around the kicker. Would we see, and have you projected, a similar type of incentive that we've enacted that would actually bump job growth and income growth in Oregon based on these kicker projections at the corporate and individual level?
Mr. Chair, Senator Deckard, I'm not quite following the chain. In terms of the refunds themselves being a stimulative?
Exactly.
Okay.
Have you factored that in, and can we, like bonus depreciation, which was very obvious, we enacted and a stimulus occurred. Wondering if the same stimulative effect would occur with the kicker that we've got with bonus depreciation.
Mr. Chair, Senator Decker, if you look at bonus depreciation, I mean, that's sort of a federal change. And I would say at the national level, these kind of tax law changes can have impacts. The problem with looking at a state law change and its impact is that a good 80-85% of the tax that's paid by corporations in the states are multi-state and very large corporations. And I won't have to question whether a multi-billion dollar company operating in all states really pays a whole lot of attention to a change in something that accounts for maybe 0.01% of their overall cost structure. So at the federal level, I can see it, because that's real dollars for a very large firm, and bonus depreciation definitely had an impact. But I would wonder whether an additional 87, or in this case 101 in this current biennium, pumped into the economy, but then probably going out in the form of being on a cost balance sheet, you know, for a multinational corporation, would change their behavior a whole lot.
Michael, can I ask that question just a little bit different flavor? You've got, looking at the kicker slide, you've got 240 and 86. You've got $320 plus million. If I plowed $320 million back into Oregon's economy next year, or the year after that. Is there some economic effect of that?
Mr. Chair, yeah, I was talking about the corporate one there. No, more on the side of personal income tax. That is real dollars than dollars that tend to remain at home. It's a real question of how they spend it. You know, if they just go out and throw it into consumption and then consume something, it's really a one-time bump up. You just get this bump up, but it really wouldn't feed into, say, long-term economic impacts. If they turn around and invested it, all $240 million, then that would have, say, more of a long-term impact. So it depends on what they do. Would they expend it? Do they save it?
Senator Deckard, is that responsive to your inquiry?
It is. It is. We can debate this.
Mr. Chair, Senator Deckard, and that's my take on, obviously, a very complex matter in terms of overall policies and how do they stimulate the economy or not stimulate them. That's
just on that, I remember 82%, is that right, if the corporate leaves the borders of Oregon, this last 105, is that the right figure?
Mr. Chair, Senator Deckard, it's just that it's multi-state corporations that make up that. And so their behavior is probably to be a lot different than some company that's owned and operated fully and within the bounds of Oregon.
Thank you. Please proceed. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Roblin.
This came to me. In the last budget, we put aside $23 million for schools if certain forecasts are met in the year. So if this
June, I think, was the June of 06.
Forecast. So the question is that money taken out of the kicker, or do we actually end the balance with $1.6 million because we've given it back?
Mr. Chair, Representative Roblin, it does not come out of the kicker. So if you look at that, expenditures would go up by $23 million to the state school fund. The kicker liability would remain, and suppose that it's all of the surplus dollars, you would end up with that being unmet dollars in a sense that you are obligated to send them back out the door the next biennium, if that's the way you want to look at it.
Okay. Thank you. Please proceed, Michael.
And the corporate income tax, I know we already talked about this, but it is now $86.2 million above the close of session forecast, so that would also, if this were to hold, would result in a similar kicker credit to what we have for 2005.
I'm sorry, Senator Fields.
I'm just new to this and catching up a little bit. Senator Deckard was talking about that $86 million projected kicker, and what he just said is just correct. 82% of that would go out of state. Is that what you were saying, Senator Deckard, or can you comment, sir?
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, the companies that would realize the reduction in their tax liability, 82%, or they account, or 82% of total tax liabilities accounted for by multi-state firms. So 82% of that kicker credit, in a sense, or estimated-wise, would go to those companies. Now, what they do with it is, who knows what they do with that. How do they respond to a lower tax liability in Oregon? Do they open up a plant and hire new people? I mean, that's the question, is to what degree does a lower state tax liability for a multinational change their behavior? And would it, in fact, lead to any dollars coming to Oregon or staying in Oregon? It's more complex than the personal, where a check actually goes to somebody who lives in Lake Oswego and they've got more money and they turn around and say, walk down and buy something. That, you can see that being fairly straightforward. But in terms of the corporate tax laws, it's kind of difficult to see how they would respond.
Thank you for the clarification, I guess.
Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the corporate kicker only goes to C corporations, not to S corporations or limited liability companies or partnerships.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Shields, it's C corps. So.
Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry, Representative Boquist. I'm sorry, Representative Barry Kitts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to make sure I understand that, being the new kid on the block on the Revenue Committee. If 82% of the total corporate tax liability is of multi-state, multinational corporations, how is the liability of that 82% here in Oregon figured. Does that make sense to you?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yeah, I'm going to need a little bit.
How is their liability to Oregon figured? If 82% of the corporate tax that comes in is of multi-state, how are there, is their liability to Oregon? I think it's better to Oregon figured.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative, okay. A multi-state company will file their federal form, and then, so they'll have a federal income level. And then as of July 1st of this year, it becomes a simple matter of saying how much sales did you make in Oregon, how much sales did you make nationwide, that percentage is then applied to your income federally to get your Oregon taxable income.
So there's not just what comes to mind is an evasion opportunity for these big corporations to, you know, start up, you know, incur this huge expense and startup costs in a different state and offset that with their liability to the state of Oregon. So you're saying that's not feasible, not probable.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, I'm definitely not an expert. There are two people behind me who have a better idea of the mechanics, the explicit mechanics, but I don't think so.
Thank you.
We'll get into the apportionment factor a little bit later on, yeah. Representative Kitts. Let's see, Representative Boquist.
Hey, thank you, Chair. And just to clarify, and I think I'm correct, Mr. Chair, or Mr. Chair, or Mr. Chair, either one can correct me. Just to clarify the members, the corporate kicker is, in fact, a credit. There is no checks issued out, and that credit must be used in the state of Oregon versus the projected kicker for personnel is actually checks issued out to individuals.
It's been used as a reduction of the current taxes due, in effect. So a corporation which paid a huge amount during the time that the kicker was created, and they have a much lesser tax liability at a later time, then what happens is it's disproportionate to that particular company. So, and there's some theory that companies can order their financial affairs in such a way that they may owe a larger tax at a later time and take a larger tax credit against it at that later time as well.
Okay.
Representative Roblin? Okay. Further questions of Michael as you proceed, please, Michael?
Sure. So in terms of risks here, generally speaking, it's still early. We've got 19 months left in this biennium. You've heard all about the risks to the economic scenario that's been outlined. To be a little more explicit here, the corporate tax structure right now is under upheaval. I mean, it's been impacted by a number of things. You have tax law changes in terms of the apportionment formula. You've got a tax law change that's temporary. The kicker really is a one-year tax law change that reduces the effective tax rate on those corporations. So the whole system itself is in flux, and we're trying to infer from these current tax payments on the current tax year, what does that really mean? And so you've got any number of scenarios where, and I'll just give you one that was given to us by one of our tax advisors. They said, suppose I had a calendar year 2005 corporation, and they'd made three quarterly payments through September, and then right after they sent that September check-in, they heard that, oh, wow, corporate tax liability is going to be 36% lower for this tax year. They're going to look around and say, hey, I've paid more money in than I'm likely to owe. I don't even need to send in a check in December. And so that scenario is, to the degree which corporations have factored in or not factored in all of these various new changes, really makes a difference in terms of what the current payments we're looking at mean. And so, you know, refunds next year when 2005 tax year is completed could be anywhere from far below what we're expecting now to double what we're expecting, depending upon whether they really are on top of these things or they're just waiting for the year to end and they'll figure it out later. So that's, I think that's a huge factor for this right now. What happens with corporate income tax for the next 19 months is
creating higher peaks and valleys that Representative Bass was referring to, I think.
And really what we're trying to figure out here, and when all is said and done, and if no more tax law changes and the economy just goes nice and smoothly, what we're really looking for is that long-run norm. What is the center for income tax? They may be volatile, but there still is some long-run trend, and we're just looking for where is that base point upon which then you make all future projections. And right now, because it's under such upheaval with all these changes, it's tough to get a read on what long-term normal for corporate income tax really looks like.
Are other states experiencing that same upheaval as they I realize the kicker isn't necessarily the same factor, but are they experiencing the same kinds of high corporate collections, low corporate collections, unknown corporate collections anticipated?
Oh, Mr. Chair, corporate. I mean, in our world, the people like me in other states, corporate is the thing we'd like to see repealed.
Okay.
It would make our life imminently easier.
Yeah, but then you think of all the accountants that you put out of work in that process. Yeah, her name Berger's recognized.
I'm sorry that we keep putting you on the spot here, but it occurs to me that if 82% of the dollars in here are multinational corporations, and Oregon is a microscopic state in terms of the numbers and peoples and companies here, that 82% is how many actual corporations, give me a scale? 10? 50?
Representative Berger, it's less than 100.
Yeah. Less than 50?
No, I need to take that back. It's probably 150 to 200.
Account for that 82%.
The top 100 firms account for about 60% of liability in any given year, so it's more than 100. And I don't have that deviated between.
Okay, that's just. I just wanted a scale. Thank you.
Yeah, it's less than 200 firms. In terms of personal income tax, obviously the big player here and capable of moving the forecast around. Like I said, we've made revisions to what we think 2005 looks like based upon these recent payments. I'll say in particular those estimated payments. As Mr. Chair knows, estimated payments aren't perfectly reflected. That's not me.
Well, I'm sorry, we were having problems with the sound system yesterday as well, and evidently, Robin, we didn't get anyone to take a look at it, or they... I see. So if you have your pager or cell phone on, you might want to go ahead and just...
Call.
Yeah. Right. Turn those off and we'll get through this. Thank you.
So in particular, these estimated payments, I mean, with safe harbor, you never quite know what's driving, whether it's real income being earned and they're making a payment, or whether it's reflective of just the increase in tax liability last year. And then, as most of you know, our actual underlying personal income tax model projects income by type, you know, and then the tax liability that's owed on that. So I have to then go back to those estimated payments and think in terms of my model, what non-wage forms of income would be driving this continued, you know, 15 to 20% increase in these estimated payments. And when you look at the current economy out there, you certainly look at the stock market and say it's not stock market generated capital gains, you don't think. Is it the housing market, et cetera? And then what would that actually mean for the future for these estimated payments on that non-wage income? So there's just considerable uncertainty there until a year and a half from now when we get a report that says for 2005, here were the income sources and here's what actually drove that. And then we'll actually know. And the binding will be almost over. So just trying to impress you, the potential for this forecast to go either way. And in those terms, when I look at the last 25 years, the last 12 or 13 closing session forecasts, and actual revenues, and then each of the forecasts in between, I look at the variance there. When you get to this December forecast, at this point in the biennium, you're looking at roughly 4 to 8% potential variation in the actual revenues relative to this particular forecast. So in dollar magnitude, that's about 450 more likely to 900 million, far less likely, in terms of potential variation, and that's either way from this forecast. So I look at that 450, and then I look at the 460 million potential ending balance for this year, and I say basically this windfall has covered, you know, that 4% that we were always advocating as a good ending balance in terms of covering against normal volatility and stretch. See, really, we've just kind of lucked into an appropriate ending balance for this biennium. Is more the way I would kind of look at it.
Okay, continue, please, Mike.
Just in terms of the long-term forecast, the total resources for next biennium are now about $13.1 billion. So it's about $285 million increase in the resources. It would be a lot higher, but you've got $326 million in kickers that have been factored out of there. So resources for next biennium are up like $285 million. And then out into the future, like I said, these are mostly level shifts in these forecasts, so you get consequent similar increases in the future buying. In terms of growth, the kicker now, the white bars are including the kickers, so you see the greater volatility when kickers throw those revenues around. The blue bars are actually corrected for that. We're looking at about 12.8% growth for the current biennium, and that slows to 10.3%, mostly because a lot of what's going on here, some of that's temporary. Corporate jumped up considerably, is now expected to be flat, et cetera. And then into the long term, we're still looking at 11 to 12%. It's supposedly being the long term, basically, revenue growth generating capacity of this economy. So that was the general fund forecast. If there are no questions, I will turn to lottery, which also has some changes, some modifications. I have a model for the video sales that's predicated on a bunch of things. One of them is consumption spending. And I did some fine-tuning to that, and the long-run growth that looks in consumption in general in Oregon is about 5.5 to 6%, and we're expecting video sales growth to basically mirror that overall consumption. So I made a change, and what the change did was basically raise that long-term growth from about high 4% range to the mid 5 range. So long-term, our expectation for growth in those video sales is a little bit higher than it was in prior forecasts. More importantly, however, is when you look at fiscal year-to-date, since they added slot games to those machines, you're looking at year-over-year growth of about 22.6%. Now, it's impossible right now to ascertain how much of that is just the base growing, players out there with more income playing more, and how much of that is truly the impact of slots. But it's somewhere in that maybe 5 to 6% is just the base. And if you subtract, you get, you're more looking at about 16-17% impact of slots. If you remember back to when we were just incorporating an impact without any real hard data, we were looking at more 12% was the expectation. So you're definitely looking at a bump up in the base and then maybe slightly higher long-term growth. The impact there, when you look at earnings for the current biennium, we've raised that about $32.6 million. To $963 million. The only other impact is that with additional money coming in, interest earnings on the Economic Development Fund are also a little bit higher. So the bottom line, once you factor out all the discretionary dollars that go to the Education Stability Fund, Parks and Natural Resources, you're looking at an ending balance now of $22 million in the Economic Development Fund. That compares to zero. Basically, all of the dollars were appropriated during the session.
Griffin, it passes recognized.
We've had 20 years of the lottery. We're now up to $1 billion. So 20 years, that would have been, 80 of these forecasts that they were involved in. I'm just wondering if either of you know whether there was ever a forecast in which their earnings or actual collections were down. Have they been up every quarter? Or has...
Mr. Chair, Representative Haas, they did decline. I haven't done a forecast analysis of the video in terms of a biennium. I actually track it on the weekly sales.
Mr. Chair, Representative Haas, I don't recall the exact, possibly Paul might remember, mid-90s, when I think some of the Indian casinos were starting up, that we did see a fall in the lottery revenues.
Do we know anything more about the growth on the Native American casinos? Is it mirroring our growth and increases in takes? Have any feel for that?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, nationally, definitely they're looking at astounding growth.
But of the 9 federally recognized tribes in Oregon, do we know anything?
Mr. Chair, I do not have, and I don't know that they actually release their financials. Not that I know.
Okay. Thank you.
And in terms of the extended forecast, basically, as it said, this amounts to, you have a higher projection for just basically base level video sales, including the slots, and that feeds through to the rest of the forecast. So, for instance, next biennium, resources are expected to be up $50 million. 22 of that is the carry forward from the beginning balance, another $30 million of that is equated to higher expected video sales in the future. And then finally, you can see the impact or at least the distribution of those dollars between the dedicated programs and the discretionary resources. So definitely with this growth in video now projected, you're getting a growth in those discretionary dollars available in future buying. And that is what I have for you.
Thank you very much, Michael. Tom, questions from members of the committee and invited guests? It appears that there's a lot of boats that are going to be floated as a result of the projected increase in the economy. For the record, I'm telling my constituents not to plan on any kind of a kicker unless they're a C corporation. So I think that certainly by the time you sharpen your pencil in the next forecast, perhaps that $25 million razor sharp thin forecast probably goes away. While I hope that we have lots of good times and more jobs in the state of Oregon, I just don't. It's just difficult for me to believe that we're doing that well and we'll continue to sustain that during this entire biennium. Other questions? Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to take a 10-minute recess to allow the Senate to go ahead and reconnoiter and regather and regroup next door in Hearing Room B, and then we'll open in another 10 minutes, and Vice Chair Berger will call the meeting back to order again. Thank you, Tom and Michael, from the Office of Economic Analysis. We'll stand at recess.
Friends, it's the day before Thanksgiving, and a lot of us have a lot of things on our schedule, but we also have some further business of the Revenue Committee. Our chair has handed me the gavel, and I anticipate that we're going to be here at least another hour, hour and a half, for your information, and appreciate your attention to a couple of other things.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good morning still. For the record, Mazen Malik, Legislative Revenue Office. It's good to see all of you back and the new one, new members too. We have a small presentation today that will be given to you by the Department of Revenue. Department of Revenue does what you would see often, and it's always referred to as a tax expenditure report. It's a small report that they produce every 2 years. Really good reading if you have any chance to go through it any time. We have here Craig Fisher and Chris Allenack from Department of Revenue who would go through this presentation in order to be able to allow you to have more of the interaction and impact and talk and kind of background and understanding of what that tax expenditure report.
Thank you. I don't have a copy.
The chair doesn't have a copy of the...
Does everyone else have a hand copy of the... I can't live without the hand copy. I'm sorry, gentlemen. Thank you. So I just stole Matt.
And I think we, with your permission, Madam Chair, we can give them the...
By all means, gentlemen, welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Craig Fisher. I'm the Research Manager at the Department of Revenue, and with me is Chris Allenack, who's a senior economist with us. Today, what we'd like to do is provide you with an overview and some background information about the tax expenditure report and provide you with some context that I think will help you find this... this publication useful. As Mazen mentioned, it is quite a imposing document. It's a large and maybe intimidating publication, but I think with some context, you will find that it may be one of the best resources for you to understand Oregon's tax system. So that's what we'd like to help you with this morning. The tax expenditure concept is not a new one. It has existed for considerable time. The federal government has produced tax expenditure reports since the late 60s. A number of states do, probably half or more than half states produce a tax expenditure report of some type. But generally, the concept of a tax expenditure is that there are provisions of tax laws that impart some special treatment to groups of taxpayers. For typical examples of these are income that's excluded from taxation or deductions or income tax credits or property tax exemptions. And the idea of the tax expenditure is that these can be viewed as direct counterparts to spending. the term tax expenditure means that these can be viewed as, because we're foregoing a revenue stream by allowing these particular provisions, it is comparable to receiving that revenue and making a direct expenditure for that particular purpose. So that's where the term tax expenditure derives generally.
I agree.
In terms of an overview, Oregon's tax expenditure report is required by the Budget Accountability Act that was enacted in 1995. So the 07, the 05-07 report, the most recent report, is the fifth version of the tax expenditure report that has been produced. There is specific language in the implementing legislation of that act that does make that direct reference to spending. There are a couple of references in the introductory language that indicate that these tax expenditures are to be directly compared with online spending. So the whole introduction of that Budget Accountability Act does draw that parallel that some of these items should be viewed as comparable to spending. One thing that's important to note is that the Budget Accountability Act requires that the governor produce this report with assistance from the Department of Revenue and the Department of Administrative Service. So you can see that the governor submits this to the legislature each session with the governor's recommended budget. So again, that parallel with direct spending is there. The recommended budget represents the direct spending by various program categories, and the tax expenditure report essentially reflects that indirect spending through the tax system. So again, just to emphasize that the connection with the parallel between spending is there in the Budget Accountability Act. Oregon specifically defines tax expenditures, and I won't read this, but it's a quite a lengthy definition of what is a tax expenditure, and I'll just point out a couple of highlights from this definition. It does refer to any law of the federal government or this state that exempts various persons' income, goods, services, et cetera, and then it provides some examples of the types of things that are tax expenditure. And a couple of the points I'll make from this is a very broad definition of tax expenditures. So by including laws of the federal government, that includes all of the, because Oregon defines or follows the definition of taxable income as defined at the federal level, all of the expenditures that exist through that definition of taxable income also flow through in our Oregon tax expenditures. It also means that this represents multiple tax programs. In fact, the publication is highly concentrated in a couple of large tax programs, but there are actually 15 separate taxes that have tax expenditures that are represented in the report. So generally, this definition in statute is quite broad. This next slide is a little summary of kind of how the expenditures are actually distributed. You can see that there are about 350 tax expenditures total in all of these 15 tax programs, but they're highly concentrated. There are 195 of these in the income tax program. There are 120 of them in the property tax, and all of the other 13 tax programs that I mentioned represent about 37, fairly small. The next two columns on this chart essentially show, these are a little bit outdated, the tax expenditure report, again, is presented to the legislature with the recommended budget. So it has relied on estimates of revenue for the 05-07 that existed at the time. So at the time this publication was produced, it was expected that the income tax would raise $10.5 billion. In fact, as we heard earlier this morning, that's a little bit closer to $10.9 billion now. But this chart shows that these are the actual revenues that we expect to receive. And when we total the revenue loss or the revenue impact of these 195 income tax expenditures, that totals about $8.8 billion of foregone revenue. And similarly on the property tax side, and I'll talk about these a little bit more. Yeah, we have to be a little bit careful with there are some very large expenditures in these categories, and I'll point out a couple of these. But on the property tax side, we expect to receive about $8.2 billion in actual receipts for the 05-07 biennium. And again, here there's an $18 billion in tax expenditures. But as I'll illustrate, that's highly influenced by about three extremely large property tax exemptions. One, intangible personal property, accounts for about $10 billion of that. These are financial assets, bank accounts, stocks, bonds, those kinds of things. So there's a there's a very large intangible property piece there. In addition, there's a federal property is exempt from taxation. That accounts for about $3 billion of that. State property is exempt from taxation, so that accounts for about $1 billion of that. So you can easily account for a good portion of that, almost $18 billion, by a few very large expenditures. And I'll, just to provide a little bit more detail, this is essentially the same chart that gives a little bit more detail about the types of income tax expenditures and the types of property tax expenditures. And you can see it, as we saw from that earlier slide, there were 195 income tax expenditures. Excuse me. If you break these down into their components, the first two subcategories here follow from our connection to the federal definition of taxable income. So there are types of income that are excluded from taxation at the federal level, such as transfer payments. They're not taxed at the federal level. They're not taxed in Oregon. There are 61 of those that represent about $4.2 billion in foregone revenue. Similarly, there are federal adjustments and deductions. There are 48 of those that account for about $2.1 billion. So in total, of that 195, there are about 109 here that flow through from that federal definition of taxable income. The next two components are really become, even though these are Oregon-specific in the sense that we have tied to them, but the next two are, in fact, strictly related to Oregon. They're not connected to the federal connection here. There are Oregon subtractions and Oregon credits. And there are about 24 subtractions and a little over 60 credits that represent in total about $2.4 billion here. So just to give you a sense of the relative importance of the components of those income tax expenditures, that's what that is. And similarly, in the property tax side, there are properties that are fully exempt from taxation, partially exempt, and then there are some, such as farm or forest land, that is specially assessed using a different assessment mechanism. And so that's generally how those are broken down. Most of those, about three-quarters of those, are fully exempt properties. And again, these are the 37 kind of miscellaneous pieces. As I mentioned earlier, this property tax component is really heavily weighted by some very large pieces. And so to sort of illustrate that, you can see the $8 billion in property tax receipts, this bottom on this stacked bar. This is the amount we expect to receive in property tax receipts. And these are those two largest property tax exemptions, the intangible personal property and that federal property exemption that represents about $13.5 billion of that $18 billion total. Just to point out, sometimes there's a kind of a, you can see those extreme values, $18 billion of foregone revenue relative to $8 billion of actual receipts. But it's important, I think, for you to realize that those are heavily influenced by some small number of unique characteristic tax expenditures. Similarly, this is just a graphical representation of that breakdown of the income tax expenditures where we saw earlier, where it shows this is the roughly $10.5 billion that we expect to receive over that biennium in actual income tax receipts, and then this is the relative share of those four components, with the top two being that our federal connection to taxable income.
Mr. Fisher?
Yes.
For the sake of those who have not been on revenue before, would you give us a quick definition of an intangible property? I mean, I don't want to take a lot of time.
Okay. Well, it's items that don't have physical things like goodwill, or when you talk about financial assets, such as stocks, ownership of a company, or bank accounts, or those kinds of intangibles, as opposed to a property that's a real property, a home or a dwelling, or a structure.
Thank you. That's all I needed.
This next chart just illustrates a concept. When we look at those 195 income tax expenditures, it's useful to know that some of these expenditures relate strictly to corporations, some relate strictly to individuals, and some relate to both. And so just to give you an idea of how the revenue impact is distributed across the two, we've sort of shown this. Clearly, in terms of overall impact, there are more there's about 10 of the $10.5 billion represented through the individual side and about $450 million through the corporation side. But just it's also important to note that this doesn't necessarily mean business activity and as opposed to households, because there's a considerable amount of business income that's reflected in the individual income tax return. So proprietors who would file a Schedule C and report their business income, all that revenue is reflected on the individual income tax side, as would be partnership income that has flowed through to partners, or S-corporation income that is passed through to S-corp shareholders. All of that business activity income shows up on the individual tax side. So that's maybe an important distinction to keep in mind. This isn't necessarily a breakdown of household versus income, or household versus business, rather. This next slide just demonstrates the, as I mentioned earlier, the whole theme of the tax expenditure report is that there is a parallel between direct expenditures. So this slide shows the number of expenditures and the revenue loss broken down in the same budget categories that are used in the recommended budget. So you can see sort of the relative, I'll show a pie that can illustrate the relative shares of these. But one of the things I wanted to point out is you'll notice we have an other category. The first five categories here correspond directly to expenditures that we have in the budget that the legislature reviews each session. There are a number of tax expenditures that don't really fit those budget categories, and we've placed them here. We've grouped them into an other category. And as you can see, there's quite a few of those, and they represent a considerable amount of revenue loss. But these represent, there are a number of these, for example, that Oregon would be prohibited from taxing. I mentioned the federal property tax exemption. That's something that Oregon simply couldn't tax. So the idea of that having a counterpart in a program that's a specific spending program doesn't really fit quite as cleanly as some of those other ones. So one of the points I'd like to point out here is that a considerable amount of this may not lend itself quite as neatly to that parallel between the direct spending as other pieces. So that may be good for you to know. And the publication does break these out, does organize the expenditures in those program categories. So you'll have each individual component if you like that kind of detail. So with that as general general background, this is the relative contribution of each of the budget categories. And the one thing I'll point out, again, because it includes the property tax, there'll be some local revenue here. But you can see the small component of education when you're talking about this spending through the tax system, if you will. A considerable amount of this is in the human services component, the economic development component, and there's a sort of a sliver here in the education. This would probably look a little bit different than the composition of the direct budget in those relevant.
Yes, it might. Yeah, we know that pie chart.
So with that, Chris is going to talk a little bit about some of the specific information that's in the report and some of the issues and some context that will be useful for you.
Okay. Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Chris Allenack, Department of Revenue, and I'd just like to touch on some of the information that is required by statute in the tax report. There are six pieces of information that are required to be in there, and the first one is statutory authority, and that is simply the ORS statute, where somebody can go and look up the actual statute language if they wanted to, that creates the tax expenditure. Another item are sunset recommendations. Whether or not a tax expenditure has a sunset and the date of such sunset is included in the book for each tax expenditure, but each biennium, as the governor presents it to the legislature, all of the tax expenditures that are due to sunset in that upcoming biennium, the governor is required to make a recommendation as to whether to allow them to sunset or to extend them. And there's a page in there, a table that lists all of those recommendations. The next item that's required are the revenue loss estimates, and these are done for the biennium that is just coming to a close and the upcoming biennium for each tax expenditure. And for the income tax expenditure, there is an estimate for the individual tax and an estimate for the corporate tax, and as well as each of the other tax programs. Also included is a purpose for which the tax expenditure was either originally created or for which it currently serves. And as Craig was describing, each tax expenditure is categorized into a program or function, and this is just a way to facilitate thinking about the tax expenditures and tying them to the direct budget. And the last thing included is an evaluation of each tax expenditure. And this is fairly unique among tax expenditure reports produced by the states. Very few attempt any kind of evaluation. And the evaluation that is included in here, the statutory language, directs two questions to be asked. One is whether or not the tax expenditure achieves the purpose for which it was enacted. And the second question is whether or not it does so in a fiscally effective manner. What I'd like to do next,
Madam Chair?
Yes, Mr.
Thank you. Question about evaluation. Most of these evaluations are written by the agencies that administer these tax expenditures, it seems. And therefore, I would question the objectivity in some ways. And what I've noticed in this book and the one before it is sometimes the evaluation verbiage is identical to the evaluation in the prior tax expenditure report, which would lead me to believe that perhaps this isn't a very thorough evaluation, certainly not objective. And I just wonder to what extent we could maybe enforce these statutes with some media language that really does an honest evaluation, if not an audit, of how this money is, how this expenditure is being used. And I really think that's what perhaps the biggest thing is lacking from this tax expenditure game that we've all been trying to get our arms around. Your thoughts?
Madam Chair, Representative Haas, I believe you're correct. And one of the areas about improving the tax expenditure always does come down to the evaluations, because that would be the most informative information as to whether or not this policy should continue. And the decision, the statute doesn't direct agencies to perform the evaluations. It's kind of done on a voluntary basis, and we work with DAS and the governor's office to try and involve them as much as possible. And there are varying degrees to which the agencies embrace the tax expenditures and perform the evaluations. And we provide, in that role, the Department of Revenue, there are only a few that we evaluate, and they relate to tax administration. And we defer to the program expertise that lies within the other state agencies. And the role that we play is as a coordinator to provide information, any information we have on tax returns about the people using it. And we really do rely on their expertise, but I think your point is well taken, that there are other ways to conduct the evaluations.
Further questions?
Sure. What's been so ironic to me is that a lot of these expenditures are, you know, millions and millions of dollars that we just sort of rubber stamp. There's an evaluation that somebody in an agency does in their spare time, kind of, and it's still money that is not in the Treasury, as opposed to a million-dollar budget. To get that through the Ways and Means Committee, you go through hearings and studies, and people pull their hair out, and we're just on the other side of the ledger doing the same thing with virtually no scrutiny. And that's just one of the disappointing parts in this whole saga to me.
Representative Cobb.
I'd appreciate if we could follow up on that a little bit.
I will just to give you guys an idea, the reason that we are going through this book and this whole issue is because on our work plan as a committee is a discussion of tax expenditures. So I would ask that today we think in terms of that and learn from these experts we have before us rather than a policy discussion. Okay.
Thank you.
You bet. I think you can proceed. Or did you have a question?
No, that takes care of my concern.
Okay.
If we are going to address these questions later in a deeper
dialogue.
It's
on our work plan, and so this is
that's all I want.
Information for us. Thank you. Continue.
Okay. The rest of what I want to talk about, there are a couple of points or nuances that I want to highlight about the revenue loss estimates, the purpose, the program, and how they relate to the evaluation of the tax expenditure.
One more point to the committee before you guys proceed. If during this presentation, as Representative Haas has just done, there are other issues you want to put a flag on, raise your hand and by all means put a flag on them. I don't mean to cut out that kind of discussion. Just...
I'm fine.
Okay.
I'm fine.
Thank you.
A couple of nuances I'd like to mention about the revenue loss estimates. The first one is that they are static estimates. We estimate, we look at the tax law and we essentially remove the tax expenditure from the tax law and recalculate taxes, and that is the estimate. They don't include any potential dynamic effects for any of the tax expenditures. Secondly, they are done independently, and by that I mean we generate the revenue impacts one by one. We remove the first tax expenditure and we'll calculate taxes again and just proceed down the line. And so that raises a question about adding them up because there could be interactive effects among the tax expenditures that aren't accounted for.
So in other words, the sum of the whole could be...
Is misleading a little bit. We don't know exactly to what extent. We haven't gone through. I mean, one way would be to remove all of them from all tax programs and estimate revenue tax, that kind of thing. We haven't done. We've just done them on an individual basis.
Or whether you could do it.
Right. The second about the revenue, or the third point about the revenue loss estimates, is that they represent a cost to the state and local governments of the tax expenditure existing in law. They do not represent the budget impact of removing it from law. And probably the best example of this would be Oregon credits that have long carryovers. Pollution prevention or pollution control is often brought up in this context where a credit was granted, say, last year, so that if that credit were removed this year, you still have corporations who received the credit last year. They weren't able to use the whole credit last year because of insufficient liability, but they will be able to use it in the current year and upcoming years. So those are two different perspectives on the revenue loss. Fourth, loss and shift is a concept that is unique to property tax estimates. And the easiest way to think about this is probably within the property tax system, you have permanent rate authority and you have bonds. And permanent rates, taxing districts receive money by applying their permanent rate to the taxable value in their district, and that's the revenue they get. So if revenue is removed from the roll, that's simply a loss to the taxing district. A shift occurs mainly for bonds where a set amount of money needs to be raised. So any money, any value, that is removed from the tax roll, the liability for that bond just shifts to taxable value. So there's a shift to taxable. There's a shift from the people who own the exempt property to the people who still own the taxable property, and that's unique to property taxes. The last point here is really, it's kind of an other category because some of the tax expenditures can have other particular nuances to them. And the example I threw up here is the refundable credits. Currently, the only refundable credit in the book is the Working Family Child Care Credit. And the concept of the revenue loss for that, there are a couple of ways to go about that. One perspective would be that the revenue loss is simply the amount of the credit that is used to offset tax liability. The other piece of that would be the refundable portion, and that would be the amount of the credit that exceeds the taxpayer's liability and gets refunded to the taxpayer, a kind of transfer payment. What we have done in the report so far is include the total amount. It's the total effect of the tax of the Working Family Child Care Credit, so both the non-refundable piece and the refundable piece. But there are other ways to view that. Oh, and lastly, while we generate the majority of the revenue loss estimates, there's some Department of Transportation does some of theirs. Other agencies will review them and to different degrees, either individual estimates themselves or the general methodology is reviewed by legislative revenue staff and the Office of Economic Analysis. The next point I wanted to talk about are getting back to the purpose. And I just wanted to include an example here because the purpose sets the stage for how the evaluation is done. And sometimes the implication of that is the clearer that the purpose is, that sets the stage for better evaluation. And where possible, when the legislature has put the purpose for tax expenditure.
Do you have a cell phone or pager on you?
I don't.
Does anybody else?
No.
It's on.
Come on, confess.
We don't know what's causing it.
Okay. If it's in the statute, we include that in here. And the example here is the business energy facilities where the purpose is taken directly from statute. In many cases, however, that purpose doesn't exist explicitly in statute, and we are left to infer what the purpose is from whatever information we have, whether that's testimony or any other information we can find. We need to infer that purpose. Getting back to the programmer function, just wanted to include two examples of how easy or difficult assigning a programmer function is. And the first example here, it's pretty straightforward. It's the Oregon 529 College Savings Network. It clearly relates to education, and in terms of evaluating and getting back to Representative Fox's point, it has gone typically to higher education because they have the subject matter expertise. Kind of a counterexample would be charitable contributions. There's no real state agency that has any particular expertise on charitable contributions.
So maybe the revenue department. Joke.
and so all of these go into these functions. And there are four functions. I think there are five program areas that relate directly to budget categories. And then we looked at all of the other ones and tried to place them into functions. And there's a social policy category, a federal law category, a tax administration category, and a general government category. And the last topic I wanted to hit on was the evaluation process itself. As already noted, so far today, through all of the expenditure reports that have been created, the paradigm, if you will, is to have the state agencies with the subject matter expertise write the evaluations. And as I stated earlier, DOR's role has been a provider of information and a coordinator of that process. And one of the things we do after each session is we'll identify all of the new tax expenditures as well as the modified ones and highlight those when we send these all out to the agencies for the review. We do include all of the existing ones as well. We give every tax expenditure that is connected to a state agency, they all go to that state agency for their review. We do highlight new or modified ones. Or if in looking at the existing ones, if there are issues that we know, we will highlight those as well to suggest that they review them. Made that point. And the last point is that the evaluations are reviewed by DAS and the governor's office for final stamp of approval.
Madam Chair,
yes.
A curious George question here.
Occasionally I go through these, and under evaluation it just simply says not evaluated. Now, if they're required by statute and there is no evaluation, then what's the recourse there? Is the department arrest the governor? Or what happens?
Madam Chair, Representative Haas, unfortunately, we don't have much recourse. Some of them, it doesn't make sense. Federal law ones, for example, in terms of allocating resources to write an evaluation, it may not make sense to evaluate something that we're prohibited from doing in federal law, because it's not within our powers to really change that. But there are many of them. The charitable contributions other, for example, is one of the ones that is not evaluated. And we try mightily every time to get as many of these evaluated as possible. But we are between a rock and a hard place.
Representative Galizia.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned that Oregon is a little unique in having an evaluation process in the first place.
Madam Chair, Representative Galizia, yes. I mean, we're not reading every state's tax expenditure report every year, but in our review, it's been pretty rare.
So my question is, are you aware of other states that have processes that might be useful for us to look at that are distinct from Oregon's?
Madam Chair, Representative Galizia, we're not aware of any processes. I mean, trying to evaluate these, it's a difficult question. I mean, what's the context for evaluating them? Part of that has been trying to elevate them or have them viewed within light of the direct spending. That provides some direction for evaluating them. The legislature in the Budget Accountability Act did provide some direction with the two questions: does it achieve the purpose, and is it most fiscally effective means of doing so? Two things about that. It gets back to the purpose. If the legislature, if statute says what the purpose is, that's clear. But if it's not, it's inferred, and I don't know that there are any that somebody would look at and say that that purpose is absurd. But it's a lack of clarity around that that helps or that contributes to the difficulty in evaluating them, just as well as the concept of fiscally effective.
I can guarantee you that you will find people in this building who will say that purpose is absurd, but that's another joke, a political statement. Okay. Did that answer?
Yes,
is that
you.
Responsive to your question? Yeah.
And that was really it. Are there any more questions?
Questions on... Yes, Representative Gold.
Thank you, Chairman Berger. This is really not really facetious, but kind of a stretch. If some of us can't sleep on a given night here, you know, after we eat too much turkey tomorrow night, and we pick up our tax expenditure book, and we see something we have questions on, who would we call?
Madam Chair, Representative Tong, in the appendix of the report, there's a list of contributors. You can call me at the research section or anyone in the Department of Revenue research section.
Oh, research Paul, section, okay.
Paul and the LRO staff utilizes the tax expenditure report quite intensively as well. So, you know, either the Department of Revenue or LRO staff would be able to answer those questions.
Thank you.
And I am sure that they would all welcome a call tomorrow night.
Yeah.
Put Paul Warner. Where is that guy? Put Paul Warner on the top of that list. Good question and an appropriate one, except for probably tomorrow night. Or
it's not going to happen tomorrow night.
Yeah. Okay. There's further. Are we? Did I get another copy?
The summary page and the.
Madam Chair, there may be some extra slides that weren't used in the presentation.
Okay.
Was printed out and Mazen printed the slides. So.
So you're done. Okay. Except for questions. Further questions. For folks who are new to this committee, I just have to say that I've gotten so that I understand now. I'm beginning to get the semblance of the language of economists, and just about everybody that sits in that chair for us are economists. And as Representative Klomp discovered, OEA is Office of Economic Opportunity.
Not organization.
or analysis, I mean. Office of Economic Analysis. It means something else to most of the rest of us when we see that kind of... And DAS, and there's a whole... There's a new language here. Please feel free to ask questions. Anything further for these folks?
Madam Chair, the one thing I'd just like to... mention again, the tax expenditure report, the 0507 one was introduced with the governor's budget in the previous session.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Department of Revenue will be working on the new one, and you will receive that 0709 with the governor's recommended budget next session. So it is an opportune time at this time if there are certain things that we, as a revenue committee, would like to see emphasized or looked at or more details of slicing and, or, you know, the evaluation process, that would be the right time to give feedback to the Department of Revenue to be able to include that in the work.
Okay.
So chapter 4, thank you. Chapter 4, you would be willing to help us since you understand this stuff?
I would be willing to help you?
Okay, you told me a few moments ago that you're having...
Weight mile tax.
No, I defer everything.
With the weight mile tax?
No, I defer everything to Paul Warner.
Oh.
I tried to explain that to you yesterday.
I misinterpreted what you were saying.
No. I just know who to call.
Oh.
That's all I said. Representative Hatt.
Well, I was just going to say that you and Chair Butler and I and Representative Dean Felter and a few others, Frank Morris and Ryan Decker, had a letter to the governor asking for an interim committee to look at tax expenditures, and I met at the governor's office a few weeks ago, and they seemed like maybe this would be something they would do when they were sort of trying to figure out logistics between your department and who in your department and who outside in the real world and whether there should be legislators. And so I think that they will probably do something here in the next few months to try to have at least a few recommendations for the coming session.
Okay. All right. And please, as you after you have enjoyed your turkey, go over the work plan and sort of think in your own mind how much this committee, what this committee's interim role might be here. Okay. Anything further? Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your coming in and appreciate this. I have two copies of this.
Christmas gifts.
Christmas gifts. One at home because I couldn't get along without one at home.
Yeah, Madam Chair, anything in the weight mile tax, I'll be able to help
you with
that.
So.
Weight mile
here. Okay, we have anything further on this? Are you staffing for the next piece?
Yes, Madam Chair. The tax expenditure report is done for now. The next piece on our program will be the Attorney General Office. We have Kevin Neely and Beach Everett. I think they want to set up their presentation quickly, but meanwhile, I think there was a letter that Representative Boquist talked about yesterday, and we have copies of this letter that we will we were able to acquire, and now we'll
are we talking about
distributed? We're killing time until they set up.
But the subject at hand is the master settlement agreement. Right. Another heart-stoppingly exciting subject for the Revenue Committee, and this is less connected to our work plan than information that we need. Just to give the committee a little context as to why we are discussing. This is not there's background here, and please ask questions, but there is also issues that we need to be aware of.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, as if hearing from a battery of economists wasn't enough, now you're going to be subjected to a lawyer, so you've had the full dose. I am Pete Shepherd. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. I am here, as the Chair said, to give you a little overview on the Master Settlement Agreement, and I really want to tell you that there are very complicated issues here, as the Chair has suggested. My intention this morning is to give you a broad perspective and then anticipate that we'll be engaged with helping the committee as it has bores into these issues more deeply. I want to talk about three basic things this morning. First, give you an introduction to the MSA, or Master Settlement Agreement. Just allude briefly to some related tobacco issues, because you'll find that in the discussions of the Master Settlement Agreement and other tobacco issues, they tend to get all bollocks together, and sometimes they are related and sometimes they are not. And so as policymakers, it's useful, I think, for you to know a little bit about what other tobacco issues there are out there. And then I'll return to the MSA and give you an update on the current status. The Master Settlement Agreement, or MSA, arose, as the term settlement implies, out of a lawsuit, and actually out of 50 lawsuits. Each of the states brought independent lawsuits against the major manufacturers of tobacco. The defendants in those companies collectively represented at the time something over 90% of the market share. The basic allegations here in Oregon, as in other states, and the claims that the state was prepared to prove here and elsewhere were basically that the companies targeted our kids with a marketing campaign intended to get them to become addicted to their dangerous and deadly product. The states also were prepared to prove here in Oregon and elsewhere that the companies violated our consumer protection racketeering laws by misleading kids and consumers about the qualities of their product. That's in the past. All 50 of those lawsuits were settled, and 46 of the states are parties to the Master Settlement Agreement. Four states had settled before the Master Settlement Agreement was entered. It's called the Master Settlement Agreement because although these are individual settlements state by state, the terms are the same from state to state. And that was a condition of the settlement, was each state had uniform terms. The Master Settlement Agreement, as one might expect, it went, flowing from the characteristics of the lawsuits that gave rise to it, includes elements that address the public health concerns that gave rise in part to the action. And I'm not going to go into detail on those for you today, except to remind you that they are important. They were important qualities for bringing the action in the first place, and they're some of the most important reasons why Oregonians want to bring companies that didn't originally participate in the Master Settlement Agreement into the ambit of that agreement. As you can see by the last point on this slide, companies that weren't originally named as defendants or participants in the Master Settlement Agreement nonetheless are able to join into the settlement agreement even now and thus become bound by its terms. You may hear people refer to subsequent participating manufacturers or SPMs as part of the lingo in the discussion of this issue, and when someone refers to that, that's what they're talking about, is a manufacturer that has joined in the settlement agreement since it originally was entered into. The settlement agreement also contained financial terms, which probably are where the Revenue Committee's work might most likely be focused. And a couple of observations about those before I turn to some specifics. First, the settlement agreement itself does not dedicate or require the states to expend the payments that are made to the states on any particular thing. And indeed, the practice from state to state has varied. States have applied these to a wide variety of public purposes. And so this assembly, as well as the assemblies in other states, can make appropriation decisions about the resources that come to Oregon as a result of this settlement as part of your regular appropriation process. And the decisions that you make about how to spend those do not violate in any way, any decision you would make about that, do not violate in any way any term of the Master Settlement Agreement itself. The total to date in payments to Oregon since the inception of the Master Settlement Agreement has been about $479 million, so we're approaching the half-billion mark. The manufacturers are collectively responsible for making a total payment. These are centrally administered by what amounts to an escrow agency in New York, from which all the distributions are made to the individual states. Each state receives a proportionate share that's fixed in the Master Settlement Agreement. Oregon's share is about 1.1%. It actually wasn't calculated based upon population, but it turns out that's a pretty fair representation of Oregon's population in relation to the national population. The base payment against which those calculations are made varies according to some elements in the Master Settlement Agreement, but in rough terms, the base payment for the current biennium and the for the upcoming biennium is about $8 billion annually by the companies. That's about what the collective obligation is. I want to leave you, make the point here in this overview, and I'll return to it in a second, but the single most important lesson that you might learn or be reminded of about the Master Settlement Agreement and the financial terms is that it is everything about these payments to an individual state is uncertain. These payments are subject to all kinds of contingencies and adjustments, even under the terms of the Master Settlement Agreement alone, let alone other considerations that might enter into it. Some of these are things that we can affect as a state. Some of these variables are things that we can affect, and others are things that we really can't. I'll come back to that point in a second, but I just want to give you then my second major point, which is some of the other related tobacco issues that are out there. I'll start with the last one, We have, of course, ongoing work in Oregon, primarily centered in the Department of Human Services and in local programs to try and address the continuing public health implications of tobacco and tobacco products. As good as the Master Settlement Agreement is, it's not a complete answer to dealing with the health implications of tobacco and tobacco products. Working up from the bottom, the tobacco excise tax collections, you probably will want to hear, I would imagine, as a committee, a more detailed briefing at some point about what's called the Tobacco Tax Compliance Task Force. That is a multi-agency group that was formed some sessions ago by the Assembly, consisting of the Department of Revenue, the Oregon Department of Justice, and the Oregon State Police. It's a unique multi-disciplinary, if you will, approach to helping ensure that everybody who owes tobacco excise tax pays it. And so I think we'd like an opportunity perhaps to come back and give you a more detailed briefing about how that's going. And you will face, this is one of the Tobacco Tax Compliance Task Force is an issue that you certainly will have to deal with in the next biennium. The law that currently establishes that task force actually provides for it to sunset, at least the funding piece of it, to sunset, I believe, in 2008. And so this is an issue that you'll have to revisit as policymakers, I suspect, during next session. Now, focusing a little more on the revenue aspects of the Master Settlement Agreement, I want to now turn to the non-participating manufacturer law. And again, a little piece of the lingo here. You'll often hear people refer to the NPM law. And when they refer to that or to an NPM, it's a manufacturer that has not yet chosen to join in participation in the Master Settlement Agreement. If you think about this, when the Master Settlement Agreement obligations are imposed on a manufacturer, that increases the cost of the goods that that manufacturer sells. First, there's a financial component, but then there's also some part of the compliance with the public health requirements also imposes costs on that manufacturer that they perhaps otherwise wouldn't bear. As a result of that, participating manufacturers might be expected to be at a competitive disadvantage in comparison to a manufacturer who chooses not to participate in the Master Settlement Agreement. And so in anticipation of that problem, a negotiation ensued when the Master Settlement Agreement was entered into between the states and the settling manufacturers. From the state standpoint, it's in the state's public health interest to bring as many manufacturers into the ambit of the Master Settlement Agreement as possible. That price differential that arguably derives from the imposition of obligations on participating manufacturers could operate as a disadvantage to achieving that goal of bringing as many manufacturers into the ambit of the Master Settlement Agreement as possible. And so from the state standpoint, it was in the state's interest, collectively and individually, to do something to level that playing field. Now, perhaps there were different kinds of motives on the part of the participating manufacturers, and you can imagine as you sit there what their motives might have been for wanting to do something to level that field. But the mechanism that was created is the NPM law, and the way that works is it seeks to equalize the economic burdens between participating manufacturers and non-participating manufacturers. It does that by requiring the non-participating manufacturers to deposit each year into a private escrow account an amount that is intended to approximate the amount of money that they would have to pay in if they were participating in the Master Settlement Agreement. That's the theory behind the NPM law. I want to make sure that you understand that those payments into escrow by the NPMs do not themselves generate revenue for the state. That is, there's nothing from those payments into their private escrow accounts results in payments or an increase in payments that come to the state. I emphasize that those don't result in payments directly because the enforcement of the NPM law does help protect the stream of income that comes to Oregon. I want to talk about that in detail in a second. But directly, the NPM law doesn't generate revenue for the state. I want to now turn to the terms of the Master Settlement Agreement and return to that key point about its uncertainties. And these are just a few of the major uncertainties that underlie the Master Settlement Agreement, why, as you consider as a revenue committee, how you're going to look at revenue or money that comes into the Master Settlement Agreement, you may want to have a big red flag on it in terms of what kinds of decisions you make keying off of the expectation that you're going to receive those funds. The first adjustment is an inflation adjustment, and this is one of the few adjustments that's likely to result in an increase in the base amount from which the calculations are made. This adjustment compounds annually under the Master Settlement Agreement, and it has a floor of at least 3% annually. The second adjustment has historically and one would expect going forward continue to be a reduction, operate as a reduction in the amounts that Oregon and other states would receive, and it's called the volume adjustment. And the basic principle here is that as national sales drop, and this adjustment is calculated according to total national sales, that is, say, market share, not by state, but as the total of sales drop, that are made, sales that are made by participating manufacturers, then the obligation that they owe goes down. And each year, that national escrow central clearinghouse agent that I told you about in New York makes a new calculation of the extent to which the experience in the previous year has caused a reduction. These reductions each year are compared to a fixed base year. It always goes back to a comparison to sales in 1997. So the base comparison is always the same. The amount of reduction has varied over time, but in some years it's been upwards of 20% in comparison to 1997. As a revenue committee member, you may think, well, gee, that's not a good thing because it results ultimately in less money coming into the state. As a policymaker concerned about public health implications of tobacco, you may think that's a pretty darn good thing, and that really sort of the ideal public policy goal might arguably be that go to zero. It's not going to go to zero, but nonetheless, it is going to be a source of variability in the amount of money that comes to the state. And finally, the NPM adjustment, and this is a really key one. I've described to you the way that the fact that there is this NPM statute, and that keys into this NPM adjustment because in order to determine both the magnitude and whether it applies or not to a given state, the NPM adjustment requires two questions to be asked and answered. The first is, was the Master Settlement Agreement a, quote, significant factor in the national loss of market share? And the second one is, did the particular state to which the NPM adjustment is proposed to be applied, quote, diligently enforce that law that I described to you, the NPM law? And those are very big questions, as you can get just a little feel from here. The estimated April 2006 payment that Oregon is most likely to receive in the absence, and given the caveat that there are other adjustments that will be made before the final amount is calculated, it's going to be somewhere in the neighborhood of $70 million. The immediate potential for the NPM adjustment could be an immediate reduction in that amount if things go badly from the state's perspective of $13.2 million. That's our current estimate, and this is also an estimate. And the way that might occur is this. That first question is called the significant factor question. Again, was the decline in market share a significant factor in, was the Master Settlement Agreement itself a significant factor in the decline in market in share? And this is a pending contested issue between the states and the manufacturers. It's pending before a single person, interestingly an economist, who has been hired under the Master Settlement Agreement and by agreement with the manufacturers that are subject to the agreement to make the decision. And the states are collaborating on submissions to that economist. And right now, the timeline for his decision, which we believe is final, and indeed that that's the only forum in which it's that issue will be decided, is to be in March of 2006, just in time for the calculation of the April payments to the states. If the answer is yes, then it's very likely, and here we're projecting something about the behavior of the companies because they would have various alternatives, but our most probable immediate outcome is that the companies would withhold from the payments to the states an amount that, when it trickled down to Oregon in terms of its proportionate share, would be about $13.2 million from the payment that we otherwise would receive in April of 2006. If the answer is no from the arbitrator who's considering the question, then the game is over, and you don't have to go any further in the analysis of the NPM. You don't reach the second question. We don't know what the decision will be there, and really we're doing all we can, of course, to make this come out to be no. The Master Settlement Agreement was not a significant factor, but that is a contested issue. The next question, then, if the answer to the first question is yes, then there will be a further potential for a further reduction, and that depends on the answer to that second question, and that is whether Oregon, and to put it personally, has, quote, diligently enforced our NPM statute. Because if we have, then we're held harmless from the operation of the NPM reduction. Now, this is a very nasty twist to it for any state that is held not to have diligently enforced its statute, because if one envisions an outcome in which, let's imagine that 25 states did diligently enforce and thus are held harmless from the adjustment, and 25 are held not to have diligently enforced, then the 25 that didn't diligently enforce bear the totality of the reduction that otherwise would have been spread over all the states. And so the risk to a state that is held not to have diligently enforced its NPM statute is that it could get zeroed out. Now, that we don't know, that's the upper limit of the downside risk in looking ahead to these payments, and we can't really give you any meaningful calculation of the probabilities of that because there's so many contingencies between now and then. But it is a significant risk, and again, one of the reasons why I hope, if you go away from this with no other lesson, I just go away associating these revenues with a very high degree of uncertainty. With respect to that question of whether Oregon has diligently enforced our statute, we do believe that we have done that. We have done that for the first several years under the Master Settlement Agreement because the Attorney General thought it was so critical and recognized the importance of this to Oregon as such an issue of high magnitude that we used DOJ consumer protection resources to fund that NPM enforcement effort. We were very pleased and grateful to the legislature a couple of sessions ago, which amended the statute to provide a flat amount of $700,000 per biennium to fund that NPM enforcement statute. And those are the resources that we've been using since to try to fulfill, and we believe to fulfill, our obligation to diligently enforce that statute. We've done that in a variety of ways, including close coordination with the Department of Revenue. I want to just mention one of those that's on the list there, particularly, and it brings me full circle back to related tobacco issues and to the policy issue that you probably will confront with respect to the tobacco tax compliance task force. We have found it useful to piggyback in our NPM efforts on the efforts of the tobacco compliance task force. That's the unit that has feet on the ground that has allowed us to identify product that has been manufactured by NPMs and distributed in Oregon. And that's helped us cross-check the kind of reports we've been receiving from NPMs about their presence in Oregon, and thus to make sure that they were adhering to their requirements under law. But for the Tobacco Compliance Task Force, it would have been much more difficult for us to have use that element. Now, that's not the only element in our NPM diligent enforcement effort.
That's me. I know that was me that time.
I know it wasn't me.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, me neither. I turned mine off. So, but that Tobacco Compliance Task Force has had a crossover effect that's been very beneficial in the NPM enforcement effort. So with that, I would just leave time for questions.
Questions, Mr. Bocas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Pete, could you define to us what percentage of the market are manufacturers who are not members of the Master Settlement Agreement, and then maybe further define who are non-participating members who have signed on, at least as far as the state of Oregon goes?
Madam Chair, Representative Boquist, I don't have that data ready at hand. We have, as to the market share question, we do have some data about that. There are some uncertainties about that, but we can give you a pretty good estimate in terms of percentages and market share. It has the share attributable to non-participating manufacturers has grown since the Master Settlement Agreement was created, the two classifications of manufacturers. There may be multiple reasons for that. Obviously, we're asserting that there are other reasons for that besides simply entering into the Master Settlement Agreement. I don't want to guess about it, but we will get back to the committee staff with that data. We also have, as a result of legislation that this body passed to help give us some additional tools to enforce the NPM laws two sessions ago now, we do have a procedure that requires NPMs to register with us, and we now have a very extensive registry, and so I can give you an exact count of the number of manufacturers who have registered as NPMs with us. And we believe that's a complete identification of all the companies that are doing business in Oregon as NPMs. Again, I don't have the number with me.
Follow up, ma'am.
Yes.
Thank you. In regard to that, and I know you have obviously legal things going, and if, in your opinion, is there legal ways that either participating or non-participating members, frankly, could, divert around the Master Settlement? I mean, there are obviously, after you do any agreement, you realize afterwards in hindsight that there are legal ways that they can get around this agreement as far as tobacco sales in Oregon.
Madam Chair, Representative Boquist, I think that there, let's put it this way, some folks have been highly incentivized to find ways around the Master Settlement Agreement and the NPM law. And indeed, we have had to bring numerous lawsuits against NPM companies that we alleged and ultimately obtained judgments against for attempting to evade the requirement that they deposit funds into their private escrow account. From their standpoint, of course, the economic incentive is if you can avoid that payment into your private escrow account, then you have an economic advantage over participating manufacturers who are making payments under the Master Settlement Agreement and over NPMs that are complying with the law. And so you can undercut in the marketplace if you can be successful in your efforts to violate the Oregon statute. You can attempt to obtain a competitive advantage. So there have been companies that have attempted to do that by simply not complying with the law. That's one mechanism that companies have attempted. Another would be to characterize one's product in ways that do not necessarily trigger the same obligations under the Master Settlement Agreement or the NPM statute. So, for example, you might have a product that for all intents and purposes is a cigarette, but you label as a cigar. And it's for all intents and purposes, simply a colored cigarette, but otherwise meets the requirements of being a cigarette, but you characterize it in the marketplace as a cigar. And that may entitle you to a preferential tax at a different rate, because cigars, as I understand it, are taxed at a different rate, and may have implications for how those are treated for purposes of master settlement agreement or NPM transactions. We don't have we don't know the exact magnitude of that part of our marketplace. And I think one of the issues that we're going to be addressing in the next year and a half or so is whether there's something we could do by rule, perhaps, to define that category, the little so-called little cigar category, to try and give manufacturers more guidance about how to understand when a product would or would not be a little cigar. It's a very difficult definition to reach. And we also have to be cognizant of the fact that there is a consistency question, because these products tend to be marketed across interstate lines, so we've got to figure out how we reach a definition that makes sense in terms of an interstate product.
Yes. So in regard to what we define in Oregon, Pete, as other tobacco products, are those you characterize what I think the seasoned or veteran members here already know, because we got educated on this, but in those other tobacco products, how do they fit in the master settlement? I mean, they're not cigarettes, but where are they categorized specifically? Cigarettes, round rolled items, and then, for example, the two other things we hear is roll your own or just plain tobacco or chewing tobacco. Where do they fit in the master settlement agreement? Are they in it? Are they out?
Mr. Chair, Representative Boquist, there actually are. I didn't want to complicate it too much at risk of sounding like an economist, but there are actually two.
That's the lawyer calling me. Okay, go on.
There actually are two master settlement agreements. There is a smokeless tobacco master settlement agreement. Because smokeless tobacco, which is one of the other tobacco product categories that you referred to, it's the roll your own category. Because it is a was relatively small, and is a relatively small part of the total tobacco market. I don't refer to it separately in these presentations, and also because that agreement is identical to essentially to the master settlement agreement for tobacco products. So the answer is they are the category of smokeless tobacco is technically treated differently because it's subject to a different agreement, but it actually operates the same in this, everything I've said about the master settlement agreement applies as well there. In terms of master settlement agreement, those distinctions aren't significant directly. Where they get to be of concern, though, is in the application of the NPM law, because then the definitions of how we account for the sales of a non-participating manufacturer, for example, that's selling roll-your-own product. The tobacco companies that participate in the master settlement agreement want to make sure, and we want to make sure, that those companies that are NPMs that are doing roll-your-own are fully accounting for all of the product that they're selling. And because of the way we measure those tax payments, you can't measure it according to the package in the same way. There's more ground there potentially for folks to underreport the amount of roll your own that's being distributed, and thus to try and escape the NPM requirement. So that's how it gets relevant to the MSA, is really through the NPM enforcement effort. It's relevant in different ways for tax enforcement, and again, that's because of the differential rates that they're charged for cigars as opposed to others.
Hopefully quick questions. Mm-hmm. Thank you. The NPMs have these escrow accounts that are their own. What happens with that money? I mean, is that...
Madam Chair, Representative Roland, that money is required by the terms of the NPM statute to be held in that account for a period, I think, of 20 years. And what the statute says is it's to be held there against the possibility that those companies may be the subject of lawsuits that are similar to the claims that we brought against the participating manufacturers, and that pool of resources would be available then for the state to look to in the event we had damages akin to those that we recovered as a result of the Master Settlement Agreement. During that time, those resources are walled off and not economically accessible, in our view, to the non-participating manufacturer, and it's that function of that escrow account that achieves the leveling effect that I described to you.
Paula Finn.
Yes.
Are we pursuing any losses against the NPMs?
Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, yes, we are currently pursuing and have pursued many lawsuits against NPMs to fruition. We have been very aggressive, and I think it's accurate to say that Oregon has secured more judgments against NPMs for not complying with our, for failure to comply with our statute than any other state.
Excellent. That being the case, if I could follow up, then our risk on the diligent enforcement would be relatively low. Is that, can I go there?
I'm sure. We sure hope that's correct. Let me give you the, and we believe, as I say, that we have diligently enforced the law as required by the, by, as that term is defined in the Master Settlement Agreement. Let me tell you why I, a prudent lawyer, would give you some caution, though, about reaching the conclusion you've reached. We don't know yet what kind of standards will be applied in making the determination of diligent enforcement. In fact, we aren't even yet certain in what forum that determination will be made. We don't know yet, for example, whether an Oregon judge, for instance, the judge that has retained jurisdiction over the Master Settlement Agreement itself, we don't know yet whether we'll be able to present our argument on that question to an Oregon judge, or whether instead there may be a centralized forum in which a determination is made case by case, state by state, but nonetheless in a central location about the application of this exemption. This is going to be the very first payment, the one that's due in April of 2006, that is going to be subject to a contested determination about the NPM adjustment. In all of the prior payments, this uncertainty was scrubbed out of it by agreements that the states reached collectively with the manufacturers. And so we don't have the benefit yet of even a single iteration of what it means to diligently enforce the statute. And of course, the companies are very highly have a very high incentive to pursue these claims. So this is a claim that certainly is going to be litigated. We don't know yet whether it will be litigated in Oregon, but we'll see.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this may be, I don't know if Pete has the answer, or maybe Mazen or Paul. Hypothetically, the $70 million that we receive, whether it's $70 million or whether we lose and it's 67 and 66 and some change or whatever, have we not already spent a large chunk of the Master Settlement? And of that $70 million or whatever the number, how much would go to debt service for whatever it is we already spent? And what is our risk there?
I will. That was the next question. After we were done with Mr. Shepard, if I could put it on hold and at least get the lights up and make sure that we've, because that is the question. Okay? Thank you very much. Don't leave.
Maybe I'll just move over.
If you don't. All right, Mazen, you want to?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Brockus, we have obligated a sizable chunk of the Master Settlement Agreement in bonds, and three different types of bonds, I believe. One was the obligation bond that we did in the 2003 session, and then the OHSU 2 series of bonds. Yet, if we're talking about $13 million only, that probably would still be above and beyond what bond payments are required. However, if we are in the zeroing out type of situation, that might be a little different. But the nature of the language of the bonding does not necessarily make a default on the bonds because we are not receiving the payments. The bonds will be paid regardless. It is how we bring those payments from the stream of revenue that makes a difference. So I don't think if we are concerned of the default, that's not going to happen.
Yes.
Just for the record, Mazen is the cheapest economist we have, so therefore defining what is sizable is always a deal with Mazen, because I he's probably wearing the same sole shoes for the last 2 years, but which is a good thing. Mazen, can you, what is the size of these three bonds, and what is the debt service, for example, in the biennium? Can you give us a, how much have we already spent, and how much do we owe?
I can't recall precisely, but I think what we have left from each estimated payments that we have, which is around the 70 million mark, I think we leave about 25 to 30 million, not as obligated. But I'll make sure of the number exactly, and we have those amounts today. But they are the previous in this biennium that have started in July, we did have a leftover, and that amount was used, I believe, to fund the Oregon Health Plan. So we're already into that territory rather than at a different time when we started. On the other comment about the economists and so on, I think we've gotten enough beating today, and I have to say, sometimes a little cigar is just a little cigar.
Further questions, clarification of what the issues are. I think this has been excellent. I really appreciate covering some pretty meaty stuff. No further questions? Thank you very much. Do we have anything else for the good of the order?
I think that probably concludes the...
Yes. Just a moment. Do you have this letter? Mystery letter?
I believe the staff mystery letter faxed it. That's because the revenue department was doing it, was moving faster than my filing system does.
Okay. Yeah, okay, is there anything further? Anything further on our agenda? Anything else anybody wants to bring up? Gobble, gobble, we are adjourned. Thank you very much.